This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Even as grocery store wars are raging in our more affluent areas, there are still deplorable food deserts in other parts of town, places where it is extremely difficult to get access to fresh, healthy food. The city is working on that problem and on bolstering farmers markets, and we hear about that later in the program. First, something that has been on every CMS parent's mind for weeks, the new student assignment plan. It's been talked about for months, but about 2 weeks ago, Superintendent Ann Clark unveiled that proposal. Prior to a school board vote later this month, they have been hearing from parents, and last night, a meeting was held seeking more input, but the cost of the plan has still not been revealed. That's going to be revealed on the CMS website. WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn was there at that meeting, and she joins us now to fill us in on what happened and what some of the parental concerns turned out to be. Good morning, Gwendolyn.
Good morning.
What was the atmosphere at last night's school board meeting?
Well, it was a packed house, and it was so many people turned out that a lot of people were not able to get in the chambers but had to listen on television monitors in the lobby of the government center.
About 90 people spoke. What does that mean in terms of the numbers of people who were actually there?
Well, I don't know how many were actually in the lobby, but yes, about 90 people did sign up to speak, and they were held to 3 minutes, and most of them wanted to go over that time because they were very passionate, and you could hear the passion in their voices, whether they were for or against this proposed plan.
How many were in support? How many were against the plan, from what you could tell from the people who spoke?
I would say it was pretty evenly balanced, but depending on where you were talking about, what neighborhoods and what schools, because you did have people, depending on if their students were being moved or if they were in a neighborhood where they wanted a home school, some said, such as the Sedgefield area, that they didn't feel that school was a good school, so they had not been sending their children to that particular school, but they always wanted a home school where their children could possibly even walk to school. So it depended on the neighborhood and the school.
So this plan is the work of Superintendent Ann Clark and her staff, and it's been out for about 2 weeks, but it's very complex, and little pieces and bits and bites of it have been come to be understood by parents and administrators and school board members. But there was new information released last night, was there not?
Yes, for the first time, Superintendent Ann Clark did give some numbers. People have been asking for, since it was first released, okay, how many students are going to be affected, how many schools? And last night, Clark said that about 7,100 students at 45 schools will be moved from one school to another if this plan is approved. Now, the elementary schools will be affected the most, about 3,100 students at 17 schools, she said, would be affected. And in terms of the numbers are lower, maybe 2,000 in the middle school and about 1,400 students in 11 high schools will be affected by the plan.
So if that's new news at a public meeting at which a lot of people were in attendance, what was the reaction?
Well, the reaction was more so in terms of individual schools. People were concerned about how they were being affected. They said they were still confused by this very complicated plan. And some said that they wanted more specifics from CMS officials in terms of how this is going to be carried out. How is it going to be paid for? Now, Ann Clark did say that she gave a figure of about $6 million in terms of what they're looking at spending. And that's not counting the reopening of Wilson School, which would be probably be another $6 million. But people were saying that they felt like that it wasn't really laid out well in terms of how are you going to deal with things such as transportation, how are you going to deal with things such as in terms of when students are go to school, and things like Title I, which some schools, because they're configuring it differently in terms of the socioeconomic status of schools, will no longer be eligible for Title I funds, and they would be grandfathered in for 1 year. But when they ask the question, okay, well, what do you do after that 1 year when you'll still have these students in these schools who will need that money, and they are saying they're not getting answers on things like that.
The pairing of certain elementary schools is getting a lot of attention by a lot of parents for a lot of different reasons and for good reasons as well. And there was a lot of, I'm told you reported earlier this morning that there were a mixture of views and a lot of comment about from Cotswold parents in particular.
Yes, they did talk about some were in favor and some were not. Pleased with the proposed plan. Cotswold is a B-ranked school with more than half of its students in the what's called the high economic, social economic status. And Billingsville is a D-ranked school with nearly all of its students in the low social economic status. And let's hear from Mindy Godman, who has two children at Cotswold.
The power and durability of Cotswold flowing into Billingsville is very exciting. To have a school with limited resources and little to no diversity, getting opportunities that every child deserves, gives me hope in our school system.
Now, on the other side of that, here's parent Lisa Sullivan, who she talked and some others talked about fear and apprehension in the community about sending their children from Cotswold to Billingsville.
This is an idea, not a plan, and our children deserve better than that. CMS needs to provide specific information about how this idea will be executed before the vote so that the community can react and engage in dialogue. We have asked a lot of questions as a community that have not been answered.
As I said, this is a very emotional thing for a lot of parents, and you reported earlier today that Dilworth and Sedgefield Elementary parents have also been quite vocal about the pairing of those two schools. Last night, what was their reaction in that meeting?
You had a lot of parents from Dilworth who came to the meeting, and I would say they were pretty evenly split. There were some who were excited about the possibility of having a more diverse school and for their children to be going with, having a diverse population at their schools. But then you had others who said that this was splitting the community apart. They were upset that they made Dilworth successful over a seven-year period, raised lots of money for the school, and now they're being asked to do it again in terms of when Sedgefield and Dilworth come together. And then there was also the concern that Sedgefield Middle is where the students will go afterwards. Sedgefield Middle is a D-ranked school, and parents had a lot of concern about that, saying, okay, now we're going to be responsible for three schools as opposed to one.
There's a researcher named David Armour. He's a retired public policy professor who spent decades fighting diversity-driven assignment plans at schools across the country and who's been an expert witness in a lot of desegregation lawsuits. He says that the idea of these paired schools will likely drive off white and middle-class families instead of creating more balanced schools, which, of course, is the goal here. And he told the school board that he believes about a half of the white and middle-class students assigned to the merged schools are likely to seek other options, either magnets or private schools or homeschooling or what have you, leaving these schools with higher poverty levels and less diversity than CMS hopes for. Did that come up as a point of discussion last night?
That most certainly did, and it came up mainly when it came to Moorhead STEM Academy. Now, that school, they're proposing to make it a partial magnet and spread it out among two other schools where the students will be going to middle school, and when they split this up to pre-K through second and then third through fifth grades, parents showed out in large numbers wearing T-shirts, carrying signs saying, keep our school the way it is. And you did have some saying that if Moorhead becomes a partial magnet, they would take their children out of CMS schools altogether. And you had some who said that they bought homes because they wanted their children to go to that particular school, which was very successful.
We're also talking in this plan about breaking up full magnets into partial magnets, and it's very, to me it's mind-boggling, but evidently that's part of the plan. Talk about that.
Well, what they're talking about doing is making more seats available, having the theme of the magnet across the whole school, but still the students, only a certain number would get in the lottery. in terms of this, and that's what parents were saying. They want to keep it a full magnet and don't want to break it up. And here you have Eric Emerson. He is a first grader at Moorhead, and his wife teaches there. This is what he had to say in terms of Moorhead.
Make no mistake, if you dismantle Moorhead and try to spread it across multiple schools, you will be harming every student at Moorhead today. Why? CMS has a rather poor track record of taking an outstanding school, combining it with an underperforming school, and getting anything of value. Moorhead has been built. It's working. Now the job is to maintain it, not dismantle it.
A lot of passion in all these speakers' voices. There was a previous meeting on this plan, not last night, but previous to last night, at which former school board chair, now District 5 Representative Eric Davis, spoke to one parent's question of why this decision now? Why can't it be put off until later?
Delaying the vote would essentially take this period of planning out of the hands of clearly the person who knows our district better than anyone else, Ann Clark, and puts it in the hands of a very capable superintendent, Clayton Wilcox, but someone who's just learning our community. And then the last reason why board delay, in my view, would be counterproductive is so much of our plan depends on a successful bond, and delaying this vote puts that bond at risk.
And he also made it a point to explain the implications of those bonds not passing.
If the bond doesn't pass, then we've got all sorts of problems. We can't rebuild your school, and we can't provide relief for thousands of students, not just Montclair, but all through South Bank. That's why it is so crucial to get this bond passed. Rebuild your school and to provide needed relief.
So did that come up last night? I know some school board members may be feeling the crunch to have this passed soon because they're voting toward the end of May on this.
Well, some school board members say that they don't like it either. They don't like the process. Erica Ellis Stewart says she doesn't like the process. She has a lot of questions about things that are in the plan. And now at some of the community meetings, I attended a few of those, and at the one that was involving Reed, you had some parents. That's a pre-K through 8, and it will be turned into a pre-K through 5 if this plan is passed. Well, you had parents there saying, well, we're not saying vote against the bond to be spiteful or anything like that, but they're saying this is moving too fast, we have too many questions, and that they had concerns in terms at Reed about students who had behavioral problems, and they wanted to stay pre-K through 8 so they could work with those students and not suspend them when they may act out, but work with them, they know them, and they mentioned things like that. Now, when I was at the Huff Hopewell meeting, you did have some parents there whose children would have been attending Huff and now will be going to Hopewell, which is, I think it's a D-rated school. But they talked about, okay, vote the bond down, let's start over, bring everybody back to the table, and let's start from scratch.
Because some school board members have said this is a humongous thing to digest, to understand the intricacies of it all with a very short timeline to do so, because I think they're voting, May 23rd, May 24th on this.
24th.
But they are listening to parents, and they are holding another meeting to do just that. What, next week?
Well, they're having a work session, the board members, and they said that then they will take into consideration a lot of the suggestions they heard. They had 23 of these meetings, and they said that they will look at tweaking some of these things and seeing if they can take some of the concerns and suggestions into this plan that they are proposing.
WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn at the meeting last night that the school board had to talk about the new pupil assignment plan. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
When we come back, food deserts, farmers markets, and what to do about both of them. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and South State Bank, committed to bridging the gap between a big bank and a small one, offering commercial banking, private banking, and wealth management. Details at southstatebank.com. And the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org. Lots of children face incredible odds in life, but that doesn't have to be condemn those children to a life at the bottom of the heap. Steve Pemberton faced those kinds of odds, and today he is the chief diversity officer at Walgreens. He was a child in the foster system for 11 years, facing abuse and neglect in a situation that could not or would not help him. And he's written a book about his struggle and how children in the foster system can be helped. He helps them himself, and he will share his story with us tomorrow on this program at 9.
President Trump's decision to fire the head of the FBI has some senators outraged and others scratching their heads.
To suddenly fire him in the middle of this investigation and say that it's caused by actions taken last year just doesn't add up.
I'm Kelly McEvers. The latest on the fallout and what's next for the Justice Department this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Harris Teeter, Publix, and other major grocery store chains are fighting it out in more affluent parts of town. But there are other areas that would wish for a single store in which they could find fresh, healthy food. 87,000 Mecklenburg County residents live in these so-called food deserts. And the city is examining what to do about these dead zones. They're also investigating what can be done to help farmers' markets as part of the overall food system in Charlotte. These two efforts actually go together, and we're going to hear about both during the rest of this hour. Lynn Caldwell is a local food activist involved in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Food Policy Council and the executive director of the Charlotte Food Innovation District, and she's also the founding partner or a founding partner of Suede Onion. What is suede onion?
Suede onion is about texture and layers in our local food system. We exist to make connections, build networks, to grow food businesses, and to inspire people to appreciate food.
Okay. Also with us, John Short and Tom Warshauer. They're from the City of Charlotte's Housing and Neighborhood Services, and John is the Northeast Community Engagement Manager there. Tom is the Assistant Director. Welcome back, Tom. Welcome to you, John. Good to see you.
Great. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
87,000 people living in these so-called food deserts. That seems like a high number for our population, is it? Who wants to take that? I'll give it to you, Tom. Go ahead.
Well, there have been a number of studies that have taken a look at where there are food deserts in our community and how people all over our city have access to fresh foods and vegetables and just have access to grocery stores. One of the critical components in taking a look at that is where places are located, but also where people have access to cars to get there.
Right.
Our whole food distribution system has sort of become based on taking a big car to a big grocery store and loading it up with food and taking it back to a big freezer. That's not how everyone in our community has access. People often really need walk-up markets, need places where they can go more frequently by bus and by public transportation. And that's become increasingly challenging as people increasingly go to bigger and bigger boxes that require a different kind of distribution system.
And people don't remember the day when you could walk down to the corner A&P or some smaller grocery store and get your fresh fruits and vegetables and go to the butcher and things like that. Now it's in these big box grocery stores because it's more economical for the grocery chains to do it that way.
Right, and people appreciate being able to buy in bulk at Costco, at Sam's Clubs. Mm-hmm. So the distribution has changed, and that's left a lot of people that don't have great access to transportation out of being able to have affordable food.
These food deserts are officially known as high food insecurity risk areas. That's a fancy term. What does that mean?
Well, it has to do with income and access. So if you don't have a strong income, it's really harder for you to make sure that every night you have food on your children's table and food on your table. And so food insecurity is really tied to access to access to supermarkets, and it's also tied to your income, your ability to afford fresh food. And fresh food is more expensive than some of the other products that are available to you when you're looking at how you're preparing your family's food that evening.
Where are these food deserts in Charlotte, John?
Well, I think, I'm not officially conducting any surveys on that, but we would suggest that they're in lower income neighborhoods. Some of the Food Policy Council studies have indicated that the further reaches of the city boundaries, way out east side of Charlotte, way out the west side of Charlotte, those areas and some inner city areas that have the highest concentration of food desert and people living in those areas, which probably isn't really that surprising. Those are the people who are not in as close proximity to a grocery store or something of that nature, and B, people of a lower income area that may not be able to afford.
The 2015 State of the Plate report, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Food Policy Council identified these areas as being food deserts: West Boulevard corridor between Billy Graham Parkway and 485, Brookshire Boulevard corridor between 85 and 485, and Albemarle Road between 485 and the county line. These are all relatively low economic areas, but everybody has to eat to live. So there's a built, it seems to me there's a built-in marketplace to sell food. Why aren't grocers availing themselves of that opportunity?
Well, grocers are chasing where they find that there's sufficient income for them to make to serve the markets they want. But there are grocery stores in a lot of places that may not be the grocery stores that people want. There's some areas of town that are Harris Teeter deserts. People have increasingly seen international foods come into the community, and they want a more traditional grocery store. There are places that are now being served in a very innovative ways by people like Aldi's. And Food Lions are going into traditional, into some of these areas. So we are seeing grocers, different kinds of grocers, and serving different kinds of communities in our city, making changes that sometimes people are uncomfortable with. But there are areas along West Boulevard, along North Graham. There are areas where people have seen that they had grocery stores, used to be served by Wayne's and other independents, that are now gone.
Right.
And it's been really challenging for other grocers to come in and to acquire, the, particularly these urban locations that are really expensive to assemble enough land to make their platform for serving really work. So it's very expensive for people like Publix to come in and to find a location in an urban area that's large enough for their footprint. And that becomes a problem in other areas of town.
Lynn Caldwell has her fingers in a lot of food pies here, figuratively speaking.
Yes, she does.
You're the executive director of the Charlotte Food Innovation District. What is that?
So the Charlotte Food Innovation District was a platform idea that I developed that was created to promote this idea of connection and developing infrastructure for Charlotte that builds things that will make distribution and access possible. It's about job creation. It's about aggregation and distribution. It's about talent retention in the Charlotte area. We have our talent pool is tremendously lacking in the food world here. And
what is that? What kind of talent are you talking about? Farmers, restaurateurs, grocers?
Yes. We need more farmers. One of the things that we are seeing as more farmers markets emerge is that they're pulling on our existing very small pool of farmers that are in the Charlotte region. And everybody wants a farmers market in their community. And I love that idea. But I think what we need to be doing is trying to connect those farmers markets and educate people about where they are and what's there. The Food Innovation District concept was evolved, and I had the tremendous opportunity through Social Venture Partners to pitch at Seed 20 and talk about aggregation and distribution, building a culinary incubator, teaching people about how to grow food in innovative ways, which I'm starting to see happen around Charlotte, and inspiring businesses to emerge that address those issues.
C20, for people who don't know, is an opportunity for people such as yourself to give essentially what is a 10-minute or a 5-minute TED
Three
talk.
Minutes.
3 minutes.
3 minutes.
TED talk to make your pitch for your pet project to get funding from from various sources, and a lot of good work has been done as a result of C20.
Right.
Efforts have been made in areas like the West Boulevard corridor to create neighborhood run grocery co-ops or nonprofit food buying clubs. Are you part of that?
I know people that are involved with those efforts.
Where do those efforts stand? Do we know?
Well, there's work along West Boulevard with Seeds for Change that Ricky Hall is working on pulling together. There also Rosa Parks has a farmer's market run by the county that's run with Elliot Royal, and the mm-hmm. county does that. They'll be starting off in June again on Tuesday afternoons to have Tuesday mornings. To have a farmer's market there. So there are a number of people that are going into this space of working to develop markets in these areas that sell both urban farm products as well as rural farm products to communities that have been traditionally without them.
Urban farm products would come from what? Neighborhood gardens?
We're seeing neighborhood gardens, community gardens, and urban farming. There are people that are interested in how they can really grow in urban areas to meet urban demands. Wow. That it's not just rural farming, that you can do, you can grow in urban areas with aquaponics, hydroponics, and just on areas underneath utility lines and in backyards. So
Do we have a lot of those going? A lot of those kinds of projects going on here?
We don't have a lot, but we do have a number, and there's a real interest in that. And people saying, rural farms are great, and we need more farmers. But it's also possible to have this be an urban, be solved and be contributed to by people in urban areas entering into this market.
These so-called food deserts, there are corner stores in many cases that have products for sale, but they're not necessarily always the healthiest products. They're packaged goods and goods with lots of sugar and fat and whatever. What is stopping these locations from stocking fresh fruits and vegetables and things like that?
Is there Austin waste?
Cost and waste, meaning there's not enough demand from their customers for these products?
I feel like access to fresh food is not just about putting fresh food in people's hands.
Okay.
It's about education around that. It's about them having the tools, the time, the knowledge to take that fresh food and do something with it. Corner stores just don't have the space for that.
And you're saying that we need to create a market for this because there's a whole segment of the population who doesn't understand the need to eat fresh fruits and vegetables. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think people understand the need to eat fresh fruits and vegetables, but people are challenged both by the cost and by the time in their lives to create dinners using fresh fruits and vegetables. We've lost some of the skills, and we've also lost some of the time. And it's not just in low-income areas that those skills and interests have been lost. We see people that are pulling into Kentucky Fried Chickens and going home to large houses and serving them off of granite and going into smaller houses and serving them off of formica. I mean, this is happening all over our community where people are really stressed to find the time to prepare food. Well, so it's iterative. It's about making it available, but it's also about increasing the skill level for people to be able to do
it. We've also seen examples of fast food chains. I don't need to mention any names. All the major fast food chains have occasionally put on their menu foods that are better for you. They're more balanced. They do contain fresh vegetables and things like that, or lower in fat, lower in sugar, and people don't buy them.
Well, they cost more.
Why is
that? There is...
Why?
I believe that as a culture, we have lost an appreciation and an understanding of the true cost of food. And if you have the opportunity to buy something off of a dollar menu versus paying $5 for a salad, what are you going to choose if you got to feed a family of five on a low income?
So prepared foods are becoming a bigger part of grocery stores as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not just in the fast food market. In Europe, more than 50% of grocery sales are now prepared foods, and that's really happening in America. We're seeing that inside Trader Joe's. We're seeing that inside of all the stores we go into. More and more people are buying foods that are prepared even inside of grocery stores.
Right.
The sort of managing fresh foods inside your home is a challenge for people. There's a lot of waste inside of that, of getting it home, making sure you use it before the food goes bad.
Right.
So there's a real skill level for us to recreate in how we use this, and that needs to be a component. But along with being able to increase the skills, you have to have access to begin to use it. So they go together.
And I think there's an opportunity to reduce some of that waste and with prepared foods because one of the food innovation district concepts was incubating businesses that do that, that capture some of that waste of fresh food that would otherwise be composted or tossed out, and creating prepared foods that are better for you.
Correct.
In 2015, Mecklenburg County Public Health adopted a model called the Healthy Corner Store Initiative. It looked at 200 corner stores in 6 zip codes. I'll name them: 28205, 28206, 28208, 28212, 28216, and 28217. And they tried to build these are all poorer areas of town. And they tried to build relationships with store operators, asking them to make gradual changes. Did it work?
I don't know the update on that one. Sorry about that. All right. I know that people have gone into a number of the corner stores to try and figure out how they can make these foods available and to provide some incentives on for the shop owners to create the refrigeration that's needed and to connect them to fresh food markets. And I don't know what the success has been inside that space.
Well, let's get into farmers markets, because I said in the beginning that these two efforts to make a dent in the food deserts and also to help farmers markets, which evidently are – it really surprises me. They're struggling in Charlotte. And these two efforts go together. Is that because farmers markets are a possible answer to the food desert problem? Is that why they are going together? If you could locate a farmers market, John, in a food desert, that would be helpful?
Absolutely. That's definitely something we're looking at, the city, and part of our study is to see what role farmers markets can play. It's that convenient. It's right there in the neighborhoods, hopefully. It's solving a lot of that access problem for people who don't have transportation. It's right there in their community. And hopefully we're able to take it a step further and show people when they come to the farmers markets the benefit of getting those healthy foods.
Can they afford to buy those foods from the farmers markets?
Well, we're interested right now in looking at how our EBT programs, how are SNAP programs.
EBT is the food stamp program, is that
correct?
What that is?
Okay. How are they being incorporated into farmers markets around town to help alleviate that problem, to make it more affordable and cost effective for people? And we're hoping to get more information about what it takes to do that and get as many farmers markets to be on board with that as possible, because as you said, that can be a barrier sometimes, is the cost. But with that program in place, it's really, really helpful.
Would they have to lower their prices, the farmers, to operate effectively in those areas?
One of the options is programs that are in other areas like Wholesome Wave that do double up farmers market bucks, and they do matching dollar for dollar, people's fresh food purchases. There's the perception that buying local fresh food is more expensive than buying other food. And I get it. I started Atherton Market, and we take EBT. We had a matching program for a while and found that because Atherton Market is not in a low-income area, and so we just weren't able to attract people that were willing to take advantage of that.
A recent study shows that awareness of the importance of local healthy foods is increasing, which is why it surprised me when I read yesterday that at the same time that's going on, farmers markets are hurting here. When we come back, I want to talk about why that is, and if they're hurting, would they be hurt more by diluting them, spreading them out into these food desert areas as well, widening their reach when we have too few farmers to supply the markets that we already have? We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bradley, a full-service law firm serving the construction industry in Charlotte and throughout the nation, partnering with clients for all their legal needs. Details at Bradley.com. And NC Warn, working to slow climate change by curbing methane emissions from the fracked gas and power industries. Information on clean energy alternatives at ncwarn.org. The aftershocks continue over President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey yesterday. North Carolina Senator Richard Burr, the Republican chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, says he is troubled by the timing and reasoning behind Comey's sudden sacking. Democrats are demanding a special prosecutor take over the probe that Comey was spearheading into possible collusion between Trump, the Trump campaign, rather, and the Kremlin. And that will be the topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes during On Point with Tom Ashbrook.
It is so easy to get buried underneath daily headlines and to miss the nuance of what's going on and why.
It would not fund a top Trump priority.
Job growth remains solid, wages are rising, and
the status quo establishment.
With each story, we take the time to ask another question, to give you the background, to make sure you know the answer to why. Listen every day.
At 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the food system in Charlotte with regard to these high food insecurity risk areas or food deserts, and also farmers markets and the role they play in the food system in Charlotte, with Lynn Caldwell, Executive Director of Charlotte Food Innovation District. John Short is the Northeast Community Engagement Manager for the City of Charlotte's Housing and Neighborhood Services Department, and Tom Warshauer is the Assistant Director there. As I said, a recent study shows more people are aware of the importance of eating fresh, healthy food, and yet a lot of that fresh, healthy food can come from farmers markets, which are at the same time hurting. In fact, Kathleen Purvis in the Charlotte Observer reported last month that there are too many markets fighting for too few farmers. This sounds like an impossible situation. How do you spread the influence of farmers markets into places like food deserts? How do you do that in the face of declining farmers?
And that's why the city has been talking to people about initiating a study to really take a look at what we can do to both enhance the ability for more people to go into farming and to really support rural and urban farming, and then connect them to an urban marketplace. And what is the city's role and the private sector's role in creating a more robust food system that serves all of us? That's really the goal of our study, is to take a look at that very question.
Are these farmers markets a victim of their own success? Because for a while there, it looked like, everybody was going to a farmers market, particularly on the weekends. Every weekend they were jamming these places.
Well, I think people really enjoy markets. They want to meet their growers and their makers and their bakers. They want to meet people that are creating the goods that they're consuming. They want to make sure that they're consuming healthy food, and they'd like that healthy food to be local. So there's a growing movement of people that are trying to take more control over the way that they eat and the way that they consume. And I also think that one thing that's happening is that people really like these authentic places. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing more and more people wanting to connect in a marketplace. And that's one of the city's principal interests in this, is to create places that are authentic throughout our community, where people of diverse backgrounds, diverse incomes, races can come together and can meet around food, but also around things that are homemade items, whether they're food products that are homemade, whether they're ceramics, whether they're incenses, soaps, all sorts of homemade products. People are sort of craving that authentic experience. For us to become sort of this winning city of tomorrow that we are talking about in the city of Charlotte, we need to make places where people can come together. You just led on a sequence about diversity inside the school systems. We need to be able to create opportunities for people of diverse backgrounds to come together. And these marketplaces, city markets, that sometimes are food-oriented but sometimes may be oriented towards other kinds of products, create that kind of diverse opportunity for people to come together.
And you're having that kind of success, you just told me off the air, at the Eastland Mall Farmers Market, which is what, once every Saturday?
Yes, on Saturday and Sunday.
Okay.
They have a marketplace with about 100 vendors. Not so much on food yet, but lots of other products from around the world are there, some prepared foods and some food. Okay. But it's incredibly exciting to see that parking lot at Eastland fill up on Saturdays.
People are finding new and different and, unanticipated ways of getting food directly from farmers as opposed to going to farmers markets.
Well, I think we need to create opportunities for farmers to do what they do the best and what they need to spend time doing, which is to grow food. And the aggregation and distribution through food hubs, through companies like Freshlist, Jesse Ledbetter has is building an incredibly successful operation here. It's working with farmers so that they can spend time growing food, and he is the distribution and marketing piece.
So how does that work? He goes to the farmers. He aggregates.
Farmers bring food to him.
Okay.
And
then what happens?
And then he works with consumers, restaurants, other organizations to bring the food together and then deliver the food to them in a consistent, convenient way. Because those are two words that I think are really key right now.
So is this and I've known people who had produce delivered to them on a regular basis in a box.
Right.
And you didn't always know what you were going to get, but you knew it was fresh from the farm that day in that box, and you paid a subscription fee for it.
PSAs.
Is that an alternative in these food deserts that we're talking about? Could that happen? Because a lot of these people, as you said, Tom, don't have access to transportation. I mean, they could go to the Harris Theater, but they can't get there. So if it comes to them, is that an option?
It certainly is an option. I mean, we're seeing huge disruption inside the retail industry as a whole, not just in food, of having things delivered to your home. So people are seeing that happen all over, and that certainly is an option that can happen within the food industry as well.
What about I don't know what to call them, but these businesses like Blue Apron, and they're not the only one, but they deliver...
Right.
Fresh ingredients with the recipe so that you can prepare your own meal at home in about 20 minutes.
And that's a tremendous educational opportunity for people. I did Blue Apron for a week just because I wanted to have that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they deliver food to you in a box,
mm-hmm,
with an instructional card that helps you know how to prepare it.
Is there an option for doing that locally with a farmer's market, saying, okay, this is what we have available, let's get a chef, because a lot of these farmers deal directly with restaurants and chefs.
Chef Alyssa's Kitchen at Atherton Market.
So we do have
She
that.
Teaches cooking classes, and she sources everything
but
locally.
But is it possible to take that model and do it in food deserts, to say, okay, here are the ingredients you need to produce or to make X. It's coming to you every week, and every week we'll have different menus for these ingredients that we're making.
I would love to see somebody build a business around that.
I think it's possible. I mean, logistically, sure, it's possible, but I mean the business model would have to be restructured in some way, because things like Blue Apron and that are too cost prohibitive for those areas,
yeah,
that are living in a food desert. For an economic cost factor, it's just a non-option. So whatever model, you know, structurally it takes would be fine, but on the back end, the financial model of how that comes together would have to be totally different in order to make it work for both sides. I think that distribution in a broader picture is a really key part of solving a lot of different problems. Access, for one, in socioeconomic areas, but what you were talking about earlier in terms of not having enough farmers to go around to all the different farmers markets and being stretched too thin. Some farmers we've found aren't really interested in being at farmers markets. Mm. You know, they want to farm. They want to be on their farm. They're not trying to come in and sell to people on the weekends. It's not for them.
It's easier to just sell to a wholesaler.
That's right. They prefer to give to a distributor and then have that person or a wholesaler or whatever come in and sell their products to whomever for them.
Right.
And so we feel that kind of, you know, finding the nexus of all those different problems, the food deserts, the subscription services, the distribution, the lack of farmers, the how farmers markets are dispersed throughout the community, could hopefully come together and really we could take a look at that from a distribution problem and what our role, our being the city's role, is in that.
So we have the situation where people are aware more than ever before of the importance of eating healthy food, those who can afford to do this and who have access to it. But at the same time, you told Kathleen Purvis at the Observer that attendance on Saturday morning, which is the biggest day of the week for all of these farmers markets, is down at every market in Charlotte, and that participation in Charlotte farmers markets is below that of any other city in North Carolina. Why?
I think it's a time issue for consumers.
More so than people in Raleigh or Greensboro or Durham? What's so different about us? Do we know?
I will say, so I've been involved in markets for more than 10 years,
mm-hmm,
and there is something interesting about the Charlotte consumer.
Different.
something different about about capturing their attention, capturing their dollars.
We have too much going on, don't we?
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I have a lot going on.
And I believe it has been suggested that our farmers' markets could play well or could play better together. They're not exactly in it together. They're in it for themselves. Each market has its own identity.
Everybody wants to be the best, number one.
So what would that be like if these farmers' markets coordinated among each other? What would that do ultimately, and what would that look like?
We're seeing it in other places. I would love to see some kind of portal or something evolve so that markets, market managers do a better job of communicating with each other, communicating what's happening at the markets, sharing resources.
As we begin to take a look at what's going on in markets in Charlotte, this is one of the reasons we have initiated this food study, is to really understand better the food system and the market system in Charlotte and what is needed to really enhance that system.
Why is this important to the city? Why to the government of Charlotte?
Well, we have people. We have Alma Adams, Congresswoman Alma Adams, leading Adams Hunger Initiative. We are very concerned that everyone in our community has access to what they need to live healthy lives. We also want to grow our food economy. We're in the middle of a growing region, and it's a growing region not just in terms of people, but we have the ability to better serve, to support rural farms and to better support agriculture in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And that's not just here. We're seeing that happen in Kinston and other places in our state where people are really developing a rural economy that's more around food, and people are feeling that there's opportunities in the Carolinas and these growing areas to be the Provence of the U.S., to be places where people honor agriculture and people return to using their land to develop their economies. So there's some studies that have taken a look that of over $500 million that could be that could stay in our local areas for food consumption if it were grown here.
Yeah,
so we're really concerned about how to support food entrepreneurship in our community and how these things come together.
The Connect Our Future study, I think you're referring to that, reveals that Charlotte residents spend $662 million on fresh produce from elsewhere that could be grown and sold here. Why do we do that? Just because it's cheaper, it's easier, it's the blueberries on the shelf at the grocery store came from Chile?
We're interested in having access to what we want all year long. So we've developed an amazing food distribution system that delivers us food from all over the world. And we love that. We love being able to have blueberries out of season and strawberries out of season. But we're also returning to thinking we would also like to eat in a way that's more consistent with what's around us and things that are grown locally. We want to know where things are coming from. So there's a number of things that are happening in the whole food industry, and there are a lot of changes that are happening, as you've alluded to, with CSAs, subscriptions, blue aprons. There's a lot of disruption inside that marketplace.
Right.
But we need places, we need to make sure, and the city's concern is we want to make sure that everyone has access to fresh food in their communities, and that we also have access to authentic places in our community, that we're a place that people enjoy living and can make those connections.
Let me share some comments that have come in while we've been talking from people on Facebook and Twitter and emails. Zane on Facebook says, as someone who is living in one of those food deserts, the reason that they exist is due to the fact that grocery stores have unrealistic demographics that must be met before they will even consider opening a store. My neighborhood and surrounding area has propositioned every major grocery store for years to open a store, but none of them will even consider it because we don't fit the market goals. Grocery stores are incredibly backwards-looking and are missing huge opportunities in markets that desperately need access to healthy food. There seems to me, you're talking about entrepreneurship, there seems to be an opportunity here. Maybe not for the Harris Teeters, the Bylows, the Publix of the world, but for the Tom Warshowers to open up Tom's Good Grocery someplace.
Well, and there are people in Greensboro that have opened co-op grocery stores. We're seeing that happen. Mm-hmm. People really taking control and making things happen in their own communities, seizing those opportunities that are local.
Is there talk about that?
Yeah, that's part of we mentioned earlier in the show that Ricky Hall on the west side is working with something called Seeds for Change, which is a really comprehensive approach to all of these problems that we mentioned, one of which is a co-op grocery store right there in the community, you know, worked, attended by people in the community, sourcing food that's also right there on site. So we are seeing people, you know, adapt to those problems, just like you're saying, you know, kind of seizing the opportunity in front of them. If no one else is going to come, then we can do it ourselves.
Tia on Facebook says, in comment to the cost comparison to healthy versus unhealthy food, is it not a common misconception that healthy food is more expensive? An apple is roughly 40 cents, and a bag of potato chips is $1.29. A salad for dinner, $2.50 for greens, $1 for a tomato, $1 for a carrot. That salad will feed several people. Perhaps we need to start addressing that misconception and compare apples to apples, no pun intended.
Amen.
What about that?
Yeah. I would agree to
absolutely
that.
Absolutely great yeah. point. That's phenomenal.
Kim emails, I'm a farmer in the Brookshire food desert.
Kim Shaw.
You should you know this person.
I do.
You should point out that to farm in the city, you must have a minimum of 3 acres. Is that something that
that's been a struggle.
Does that need to be addressed? Does the city need to change that?
Well, that's what we want to look at through what we're doing. What are the barriers that we have to having a more robust economy around food and a more robust food system? We want to learn more about all the barriers that exist inside that system and what the city can do to remove those barriers and to support better access everywhere.
And I have to say that as an activist in the food community, we are so thrilled that the city has taken an interest in this mm-hmm. and that they are supporting the study and helping look at what the opportunities are and what the barriers are to approaching those opportunities in a realistic way.
There was
a
meeting last year among government agencies, nonprofits, market managers, local farms, restaurants, etc., to gather information. And a lot of questions emerged as a result of that meeting. How can we reignite the excitement around shopping and purchasing local food? How do we attract grocery stores to underserved areas? What kinds of stores might they be? What can the city of Charlotte realistically do to assist with creating solutions to this problem? A lot of questions and more. When do you think you'll have some answers?
Well, we're hoping we'll have some answers within the next 6 or 9 months. We've been interviewing consultants for this, and right now we're taking a look at our budget and how we can advance this with all the many priorities the city has.
Tom Warshauer is Assistant Director of Community Engagement, and John Short is the Northeast Community Engagement Manager, both with the City of Charlotte's Housing and Neighborhood Services, and Lynn Caldwell is Executive Director of Charlotte Food Innovation.